Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. I want to thank you very much for taking time out this morning to join me on the Monday morning edition of my radio broadcast. I want to take just a few seconds here in the very beginning of the program today to send my thoughts and my heartfelt prayers to the many victims of the horrific shooting, the mass shooting, one of the worst in United States history, at the Las Vegas Strip during a country and western concert. The death toll at this stands at 50 dead and over 400 wounded, when a demented shooter in the hotel building above, at the rooftop, senselessly gunned down these concert goers. And so this morning, let's take just a few seconds to send our heartfelt prayers and our thoughts toward the first responders, the police officers, the victims, and their families. Today on The Cross in the Desert, I want to take some time to develop a theme that I had on my last program, the last live broadcast, when I talked about the very important rally at the United Nations, where thousands of Iranian Americans gathered together protesting President Rouhani's speech at the United Nations and calling for a much-needed regime change. Under Rouhani, there has been 3,100 people executed. It's unthinkable the number of human rights violations against the people of Iran since the regime took power back in 1979. And so this morning, I want to develop this theme a little bit more because I want you, my listener, to understand just how vital democracy and freedom in Iran is needed. About 15 years ago, the son of the former Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, wrote a book called Winds of Change, Freedom and Democracy in Iran. And that was before Ahmadinejad took power and the things that happened later. But he made a case in the book, the necessity for an uprising and for the people to prevail, to take out this regime, to put such pressure on it that they need to be changed. Well, as I was preparing for this show today, I came across a very important article written by a member of the National Council of Resistance of Iran, Shawratar Kia, and he writes about a regime change. And I want you to hear this article. I'm going to read it word for word, but it's important that we understand just how absolutely important and necessary this regime change that should take place. And believe me, there is so much internal corruption and cracks in the wall that it could happen any day. The things that are happening behind the scenes, which of course you're not hearing in the media, because so much of the media is dedicated to the nuclear program and not enough to the human rights agenda for the people of Iran. What I want to do is talk about this article and give you an idea just how important it is for this regime to go away very soon. And this is from Shahrir Kia. And he asked the question, is the argument for regime change in Iran well-founded? And we're going to take some time and spend some time on his article this morning. Shahrir writes, during his first address to the United Nations General Assembly in September, President Donald Trump offered a perspective on the people and the regime of Iran that starkly differed from that of his predecessors. He accurately attested that, quote, the entire world understands the good people of Iran want to change, end quote. He described the Iran nuclear deal as, quote, an embarrassment, called off the Iranian regime for its export of violence, bloodshed, and chaos, and underlined that, quote, Iran's people are what their leaders fear most. These remarks from the President of the United States are a positive signal after three decades of failed appeasement toward the mullahs ruling Iran. And the testament to the fact are the reaction of Iranian officials, which betray their fear and consternation. In a meeting with the Assembly of Experts, Al-Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Iranian regime, called Trump's speech, quote, foolish, extremely ugly, hideous, and, quote, gangster and cowboy language fraught with sheer lies. Mr. Trump said the wrong things in the wrong place to the wrong people, Rouhani said to the state television. The question that remains is whether President Trump's remarks at the United Nations General Assembly were simply a reaction to the failure of the appeasement policy, or was it the result of the natural course of events and the geopolitical dynamics governing the Middle East? Has the explosion in the connectivity and social medias been effective in conveying the message of the Iranian people who want the world to know about their desire for freedom and human rights? Without a doubt, all of these parameters have been effective. But what are the real foundation of Washington's new approach to the desires of the Iranian people for regime change? The first factor that challenges the power of the ruling regime is the looming threat of uprisings. From an economic and social perspective, there has always been a potential for nationwide uprisings in Iran. The first big occurrence of widespread protests was in 1981 when more than 500,000 people took to the streets of Tehran and demanded the overthrow of the theocratic regime. The protest was brutally suppressed, and ruthless executions of protesters and dissidents ensued. In the summer of 1988 alone, and I've talked about this on this program before, 30,000 political prisoners, mostly members of the opposition group People's Mohedishian Organization of Iran, or MEK, were executed in the span of a few months and were buried in secret graves. In 1999 and 2009, uprisings erupted again. While the regime smothered both instances with a brutal crackdown, yet the potential for another uprising remains, and the ashes wait to be stirred once again. Presently, sporadic protests are slowly building up across the country and gaining momentum. An example is the staged protests against the Arman and Caspian Foundation, two financial organizations run by the Revolutionary Guards of Iran, which has been plundering the people's wealth at an unprecedented rate. Following the start of Rouhani's second term of president, social dissatisfaction with the current state of affairs has increased. Now, the next factor that Sharer writes about is infighting. We've talked about uprisings, infighting. The second factor that is weakening the regime is the ongoing power struggle between the supreme leader and other factions within the regime. So long as the country's constitution is based on the guardianship of the jurist, every key decision will be made by the supreme leader. The supreme leader is also the commander-in-chief, which leaves the president with no substantial power. This religious dictatorship is founded on the fundamentalist interpretations of Islam and sees its survival as bound to domestic suppression and foreign terrorism. However, the mullah's crimes in the past four decades have intensified the hatred of the Iranian people toward them. Earlier this year, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation revisited the mass execution of 30,000 Iranian political prisoners in 1988 in her report to the Secretary General. Moreover, activists and international human rights organizations have called for an independent investigation into this crime against humanity, placing the Iranian regime in yet another political and social dead end. Now, another factor that's weakening the regime is the war of attrition in the Middle East. The Iranian regime is stuck in three long regional wars involving Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. Some analysts and politicians perceive the Iranian regime's meddling in these three countries as a sign of power and stability. However, contrary to what Khamenei and other regime officials have insisted on time and time again, if they abandon their intervention in the countries of the Middle East, they'll be fighting their wars against each other in the streets of Tehran. Therefore, the sole purpose of the Iranian regime's regional forays is to avoid collapse. The regime's nuclear and ballistic missile project is for the same purpose. Now, the coalition of Arab countries and the U.S., the imposition of further sanctions against the Iranian regime's regional meddling, and the end of the golden era of the Obama administration has faced the regime of Tehran with further challenges. Officials in the new U.S. administration rightly insist that the real threat of Iran comes not only from its nuclear ambitions, but also from its ballistic missile program, its chaos-mongering in the region, and its human rights abuses. The only durable solution to these collective threats is a regime change in Iran. And this is the whole point of this article by Sharer Kia. And it's from the American Free Thinker. And his argument is very well-founded. This regime is starting its decay and collapse from within. And a people's uprising is just the right thing, and this regime is facing that possibility every day. And now with the Trump administration putting pressure on the nuclear deal and talking about the internal problems and the human rights abuses, the Iranian regime is facing this threat from the Western world. And what we need to do is continue to pray that God will put pressure on this regime, and there will be a collapse from within, and that the people of Iran will one day see their dream of freedom and democracy coming true. I want to thank Sharer Kia for his article entitled, "Is the Argument for Regime Change in Iran Well-Founded?" I want to continue with the news going on in Iran, because here on the Cross in the Desert, I like to keep us informed of the situation of political prisoners. And one particular person that we haven't talked about in a while is Atena Daemi, who has been, of course, set free and then recaptured and re-imprisoned. And now she has refused urgent surgery in protest of the regime's treatment of her. Atena Daemi, who was sentenced to seven years in jail on bogus charges, was told that in order to have her operation, she would have to remain handcuffed and shackled while in the hospital. When she refused, she was taken back to the Notorious Evan prison, and that was on Monday, September 25th, without any treatment. Her mother, Masumi Amati, said, quote, "I do not understand how a prisoner who has been imprisoned for her beliefs could escape from the hospital. Where can she escape to?" Well, let me explain this whole problem here. People recovering from surgery, or those in desperate need of surgery, are rarely going to climb out of a hospital window and escape. Namati also explained that her daughter had been banned from having a relative attend the hospital for moral support. Now, Tehran's prosecutor, Haj Moradi, had previously met with Atna's father and promised that Atna would not be restrained and would be allowed to receive visitors. But when the family spoke to Moradi afterwards, he pretended there was nothing he could do. So, once again, this is an example of what happens in Evan prison. This is a very serious operation, especially for Atna at this time, and I want to talk about that a little bit with you. The serious risk of infection that could go on with Atna as she faces this surgery. She has renal and gallbladder problems that were first diagnosed back in April, and they were relatively minor at that time. But when the family spoke, they urged her to have this surgery, but she refuses to be shackled to a hospital bed. And so this is a very, very serious situation. She's been accused of faking her illness. She went on a 54-day hunger strike over the treatment of political prisoners. And at that time, Atna was diagnosed with gallstones and kidney infections. And so the head of the Evans dispensary even filed charges against her for protesting her condition and insulting officials. And that is despite the fact that specialist doctors have already confirmed that she has this problem with gallstones and her kidneys. And so what we really need to do today is lift up Atna Dami in prayer. She needs this surgery, but she's rightly protesting being shackled and chained to her hospital bed. And so she needs God to intervene in her situation. And just please join me today as we think about Atna and we think about her situation and her need for a surgery. I want to turn our attention now to a situation that is very grim going on in Egypt, and that is with Coptic Christian girls who are being kidnapped and being sold into sexual slavery and married to Muslims. This has been going on for quite a while, but I want to bring this to your attention of what's happening not only in Iran, but in the Middle East as well with the problem of Islamic domination. So I want you to hear this special report right now on the cross in the desert.
Magda Kaiser, an Egyptian Christian, weeps over her missing daughter, Mary.
She was our only daughter, so we spoiled her. She got whatever she wanted, but she was very shy. We were close friends. She never went anywhere without me. She always asked me to go with her because she was afraid of being alone.
An exceptional student, Mary won mathematical achievement awards. At the age of 19, she entered university to study pharmacology. That's where she befriended a Muslim classmate. One night when the two women went out together for pizza and a movie, Mary suddenly fell ill. Friends last saw her entering a taxi.
We knew she was missing because she didn't come home that night. We believe her Muslim friends put drugs in her food and hired people who abduct young Christian girls to kidnap her.
A day later, police informed Mary's family they had located her not far from Cairo, in the town of Kardasa. They said Mary had converted to Islam and had married a Muslim vendor. Magda and her husband suspected foul play. They believe their daughter had become a victim of a vast Islamic human trafficking network, one targeting young Christian women.
All this was coordinated between the government, police, and the Wahhabis. Everyone was in on it.
Officials summoned Mary to the police station, where her father waited to see her.
Four veiled ladies and four bearded men walked into the police station, accompanied by two policemen with machine guns. As they walked by, my husband screamed out our daughter's name, Mary. As Mary turned around to acknowledge him, one of the bearded men pushed her away and punched her in the face.
Overcome by rage, Mary's father demanded to talk to his daughter. The police refused and ordered him to leave. They said they closed the case because Mary was now a Muslim.
This used to be a home of much joy, laughter, and happiness. But 5 years after Mary's disappearance, her bed remains empty. The emotional hurt still lingers. And her family says that she was a devout Christian. There's no way she would have willingly embraced Islam.
Abduction cases like Mary's are now commonplace in Egypt. A new study finds the number of disappearances and abduction of Egyptian Christian girls is increasing. Kidnappings of underage females and mothers of young children are also on the rise. George Washington University professor Michelle Clark is one of the authors of the study. She testified recently before the Helsinki Commission, debunking arguments that suggest Christian girls are leaving their faith and families simply for romance.
They say yes to friendship, to romance, to hope, a future, safety, and security. Nevertheless, did not consent to being ripped from their family without ever being able to see them again.
Nor, she says, did these Christian women consent to being forcibly converted to a religion other than their own, or consent to a life of captivity. So what should be done? Middle East analyst Waleed Faris says the Obama administration must openly discuss the matter with Egyptian President Morsi.
The perpetrators in Egypt must know from the media, from public discussion, that our officials are demanding from the president of Egypt, are demanding from the future elected or the current parliament, that these issues would be at the table, that the constitutional committee that is looking at the future constitution will take consideration these elements.
Professor Clark also says the Egyptian government needs to create a national registry documenting the disappearance of minors.
The Egyptian national government will request an annual accounting of all cases of disappearances, including open and ongoing cases, as well as any prosecutions that resulted from these local investigations.
Egyptian leaders are still debating the possibility of imposing a strict interpretation of Sharia on the society, law that tolerates forced conversion and forced marriage for non-Muslim women. As for Magda, she says she will not give up searching for her daughter.
She will always be my daughter, no matter what happens to her. I will keep trying to get her back. I believe in God's promises, and I trust the Lord will never forsake us. And I ask everybody to pray for us. I'm confident the day will come when I will see her or meet her again.
Gary Lane, CBN News, Cairo, Egypt.
Many thanks to CBN for reporting on this horrific tragedy going on in Egypt with these girls, these Coptic Christian girls, being forced to convert to Islam and being forced into sexual slavery, a situation that really requires change immediately and many, many prayers from all of us to support these girls who have had their lives horribly and radically altered and changed. The month of October is a difficult month for many of us as human rights activists. And the reason it is because on October 25th, 2014, Rehane Jabari was executed in Tehran, and her crime was defending herself against a government rapist. And because Rehane named the government rapist as a former intelligence member of the Iranian regime, and she refused to change her story that she was truly being raped by him when she defended herself and stabbed him, and he died as a result, Rehane was executed on October 25th, almost 3 years ago. I had the immense pleasure and honor of writing her story, of talking with her family, of meeting with them on Skype and on Telegram, and going over her incredible story. The result was a book in 2016 called Rehane, A Beautiful Fragrance, which is the story of Rehane Jabari's struggle to stay alive in Iranian prison and never change her story that this former government agent tried to rape her. I want to take a few seconds here, a few minutes here, to talk to you from the heart and read a few pages from my book. This month I'm going to be reading certain selections from this book, and then on October 23rd, I will have a special radio broadcast in tribute to Rehane. But what I want to do is just read to you the first few pages of this book to remind you, as my listeners, that this is a very tough time for Rahane's family. Thankfully, Rahane's mother, Sholeh, and her daughter are safe in Berlin. They've received asylum status. But the rest of her family, her husband and her other daughter, are still in Iran. So it's a very tough time remembering what happened to their daughter this October and missing also their family. I want to read to you just a few pages just to remind us what this month of October is all about. My beloved daughter, I will release your writings into the wind to spread your words like seeds, a tree whose fruit that cries, the cries of justice and humanity. You will be the leader of those women who live in the shadow of rape day in and day out, women who are living in the shadows, fearing an unjustified death resulting from rulings tainted with administrative corruption and patriarchy. And that's the words of Sholeh Bakrivan, written on December 20th, just a couple of months after the execution. This is a quote from Rahane's prison letter, number one, that I featured in the book. I, Rahane Jabari, am 26 years old. With a hanging rope in front of my eyes that I am not afraid of, I write to tell the tale that I lived. I want to tell you everything that I said in court, which they did not understand, and everything that I cried out under torture, which was not heard. Everything that I screamed out while I was brutally kicked by four forceful interrogators who regarded themselves as almighty. Perhaps someone in this world would hear my cries and feel my pain. Rahane Jabari, prison letter number one. Some of the final words of Rahane to her mother when she thought she was going to be executed on October 2nd, which was exactly 3 years ago. She says, in the court of the Creator, I will charge Dr. Sarbandi. I will charge Qasem Shabani and all those that out of ignorance or with their lies wronged me and trampled on my rights and didn't pay heed to the fact that sometimes what appears as reality is different from it. Dear soft-hearted Sholeh, in the other world it is you and me who are the accusers and others who are the accused. Let's see what God wants. I want to embrace you until I die. I love you. Some of the most intriguing words written by Rahane on a telephone conversation actually to her mother on October 2nd when she was in fear of being executed, but it was postponed once again. I want to read one final thing from my book, and this is a dedication that I asked my Iranian friends to write something special for Rahane. And this is Maral and Samar, who at that time were living in Shiraz, Iran, before they were able to leave. Dear Rahane, you are alive in the hearts of all women in Iran. You are a symbol of perseverance, the shout of injured women. You are a flower blossoming in the soil that will never surrender. There are thousands like you held captive in this land of animals. I wish I could have rescued you. I wish I could have taken your mom's hand and kissed her tears. But now you are safe at home with God, the place of Rahane's, the place of Neda's, and the place of angels. In this book, I wrote a short introduction called In Defense of Her Honor, and I want to read that to you in conclusion. In the Persian language, names have specific meanings that relate to life. The name Rahane means flower fragrance. Ironically, my name, Randy, in the English language means defender. I don't believe that it's a coincidence that I'm writing this book for Rahane. I am not merely writing out of sympathy. It is much bigger than that. I believe I have the God-ordained task to live up to the meaning of my name. I want to be a defender of Rahane's honor as a woman. Rahane was the helpless victim of a man's uncontrollable sexual advances, and she did what any honorable woman would do by defending herself. In Iran, the unfortunate reality is that women are the property of men in a society that elevates the status of a man because of Sharia law. According to the Quran, men are superior to women, and the testimony of a woman is only worth half that of a man's. Surah chapter 2, verse 282, Surah chapter 4, Verse 34. Rahane grew up in this kind of culture, and because she defended her honor against a former intelligence agent, her fate was sealed. The Iranian regime would do everything in its power to protect the reputation of a government man, which meant that Rahane had no hope of surviving, but instead would be sacrificed on the altar of convenience so that the Sorbandi name would not be tainted. Right before her execution, the regime brought in cameramen and reporters to pressure Rahane into changing her story. Just say, he did not try to rape me. In the midst of great pressure to preserve her life, Rahane refused to lie and compromise the truth. But instead, she stood strong and tall as a majestic mountain and looked in the face of her accusers and responded, I will not lie. The reason I chose the name A Beautiful Fragrance for this book is because Rahane exemplified and lived up to the meaning behind her name. She was a beautiful fragrance of honor, kindness, mercy, and courage. She forgave her interrogators shortly before her execution and showed kindness and compassion to the many women political prisoners who came from destitute and filthy walks of life. This book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, is about a remarkable, extraordinary, and inspiring woman who suffered greatly at the hands of an evil dictatorship and illuminated a dirty prison with the beautiful fragrances of her wonderful character. It is my honor and pleasure to defend her and tell her incredible story to the whole world from my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. This month of October, I just ask that you would go up on Amazon, purchase this book, and honor her name and her memory by reading her story this October, as on The Cross in the Desert, I will feature selections from my book throughout this month, and then a special tribute to Rahane toward the end of the month, in the third year anniversary of her execution. Well, right now, I want to play for you a very beautiful worship song of hope. In the midst of all the tragedy we've been talking about this morning, this is a song of hope. It is from Bethel Music. It is called It Is Well. beautiful worship music from Bethel, Bethel Music, It Is Well, a song of hope, a song of healing, a song of trusting in God in dark and difficult circumstances. I think I just began to drift off to sleep last night, and as customary with me, I'm very phone conscious. I don't know about you. I'm always checking my phone for messages, for things happening, for Facebook, whatever. I'm just that way. I'm a light sleeper. And it was probably sometime after 2 that I began to open my eyes and see the news of the horrific tragedy unfolding in Las Vegas. My first reaction is, it's just another terrorist attack. I mean, these are down-home, really strong Americans at this country and Western concert in Las Vegas. What on earth would anybody want to do that for? And then it occurred to me, these are the most powerful people that love freedom so much, our brothers and sisters in the Deep South, in the country Western genre. These are very patriotic Americans, is what I'm trying to say. And then as I woke up this morning and awoke to the headlines on the internet that 50 were dead and over 400 wounded, I was astounded. A 64-year-old demented man from a rooftop apparently overlooking the venue had a machine gun or something and was taking shots at them, much like the Texas sniper back in 1965 who shot the students at the university. I think it was in Austin, Texas. Not sure. But the reality of violence and death is all around us. Seemingly, we can't go through a week unless we are confronted with horrific changes in weather, hurricanes, and now mass shootings or terrorist attacks. And so the reality that we face every day in our busy lives is that this life is short, that unexpected things can happen just out of nowhere. I imagine these concert goers enjoying this music, and suddenly the air was filled with tumultuous sounds of gunshots. And the reality of death and violence took over and shattered the peaceful night. All of us face the inevitable reality of death one day. It's a subject we prefer not to talk about, and instead to continue to make plans and pursue our dreams. Yet it's unavoidable. Death is all around us. Our lives are rudely interrupted by the tragic news of a best friend killed in a car wreck, or a next-door neighbor facing terminal cancer. The headline news is filled with murders, violence, and stories of incredible suffering and evil. The lives of people are shattered by this painful reality. And the question is, are there any answers that can give us hope in the face of death? Nearly 2,000 years ago, words of hope were spoken to a Jewish woman named Martha and her sister Mary. Their brother Lazarus had suddenly died, and their lives were filled with grief and mourning until Jesus arrived on the scene. Jesus gave Martha words of hope that shattered the darkness and the reality of death. Jesus proclaimed, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." This is an incredible declaration that looks death right in the face and says, "I have the final word." Jesus wasn't just trying to encourage Mary with pep talk to soothe her hurts and pains. No. Right before the eyes of Martha and Mary and others gathered in the village of Bethany, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Still wrapped in his grave clothes, Lazarus emerged from the tomb to the astonishment of Mary and Martha. Death and decay were powerless against the command of Jesus, and Lazarus was living proof that Jesus was exactly who he claimed to be, the resurrection and the life. Millions of followers of Jesus courageously risk their lives every day, refusing to recant their faith because they have the assurance that in the instant of their death, they will stand before their living Savior, never to die again. We live in a culture of fear and hopelessness, with the certainty of death lingering all around us, interrupting our plans and dreams for the, quote, good life. As a result, many put their hope and faith in science or the latest diet fads to help them prolong their lives. However, the incredible promise of Jesus is the only words of hope that can overcome and destroy the sinful curse of death upon the human race. The promises of scientific progress and the claims of diet fads are built upon a shaky foundation in comparison to the promise of Jesus. What does this all mean? Is this just a nice Bible story to soothe our hurts and pains in the face of the tragedy, let's say, this morning of Las Vegas? No, it is not. You and I can confidently look death in the face and have real hope and assurance when we trust in Jesus. He alone has the words of eternal life. The curse of death is forever swallowed up by the greatest words ever uttered. I am the resurrection and the life. The Bible is not a book of man's opinions, and it is not a book of good stories to help us feel better. Liberal theology in the early 19th century decided that the miracles of Jesus, the resurrection of Lazarus, the resurrection of Christ, the feeding of the 5,000, the healing, that was all mythological, because everyone knows we're living in a highly scientific age. The Enlightenment said that human reason was the only answer to life, was the greatest way of knowledge. Human reason, not biblical revelation. Oh, come on, that's religious superstition. Liberal theology decided, well, all those miracles, they can't be true. We live in a scientific age. I mean, but we can take away some of the good ethics of Jesus. After all, he loved and cared for people. So liberal theology decided the miracles in the Bible, probably not true, but we can take away some of the good ethics of Jesus. And so in the early 19th century, this attack, this skepticism began with the Bible. And pretty soon, the gospel became what is called the social gospel. We're going to take care of the needs of people like Jesus did. It doesn't matter if all those miracles really happened. Let's just have a good faith experience. Unfortunately, this kind of skepticism is still all around us. But one thing is for sure. The reality of pain and evil and suffering and death cannot be overcome by a mere good feeling and religious experience. We need a remedy to this problem. We need concrete answers of hope and assurance when we look death in the face. My good friend Nabil Qureshi just left this planet more than 2.5 weeks ago and is now face to face with Christ. For one solid year, he suffered with stage 4 stomach cancer. And I'll never forget in his public speeches right before he died, he talked about his suffering. He said, but it's nothing compared to the suffering of Jesus, who took our pain and our grief and our sin. My little cancer doesn't compare to his grief and his pain. Courageous man Nabil was, but he had hope in the face of death. He wasn't basing his faith and hope on a book of just great religious experiences, of myths and fables, of good ethics of Jesus. He was basing his hope on the words of Jesus, the most revolutionary, life-changing words of Jesus, who looked death in the face and said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. These words are the most powerful words in the universe. You and I can confidently stare death in the face and recognize that Jesus holds the keys of death and life. Jesus faced horrible pain and suffering in his crucifixion. He experienced death and rose again triumphantly from the grave. Because I live, Jesus says, you also shall live. This promise, these words of hope, are not just words to comfort us and make us feel courageous in the face of death. These are life-changing words that looks death and decay in the face and says, I have the final word. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly live on Jesus' name. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other hope is sinking sand. A very famous church hymn, but filled with so much truth. Jesus elsewhere declared in John chapter 14, verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. In an age of religious pluralism and skepticism and postmodernism and every other philosophy of unbelief and doubt, Jesus says, if you are lost, I am the way. If you are seeking the truth, I am the truth. And if you're crying out for life in the midst of suffering and pain, I am the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. These words are the most powerful words in the universe. And this morning, as we mourn and pray for the victims of this horrific shooting in Las Vegas, these are the only words of hope and healing that will get these people through the rest of their lives. And these are words, not just on a page, but from the lips of Jesus. Fear not, for I am with you. I cannot tell you how these changed my life. In 1975, I received a Bible as a gift from my grandmother in her will. And it was a King James Version. It was kind of a Catholic Bible, but nonetheless, it was a Bible. And I really didn't know much about the Bible. And I didn't know where to begin to read in the Bible. But it was at this time of my life when I was 19 that I had horrific panic attacks. My heart would race away. I was so afraid of death that it was no coincidence whatsoever that my grandmother, in her will, gave me this Bible. And I began to question, what does this Bible have to say about me, about death? I was a good Catholic, and I heard about the resurrection, but I really didn't understand much of it. God began to open my eyes as I sought Him and begin to encourage me. And the first thing I read about in the Bible that made such a tremendous difference in my life was the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And so when I read these words to you today, some 42 years later, I can tell you, I've gone through a lot in 42 years, but these words have been the hope and the anchor of my life. I can tell you that when you seek God for answers, when you cry out for truth, I can testify to you, He will answer your cries. He will give you hope. He will give you a hope that you can't find anywhere else. Mary and Martha were hopeless. Their best friend had died, Lazarus. Where were you, Jesus? If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus had deliberately delayed his coming so that before a group of people, he could display his incredible power over death. I don't know what situation you're facing today. If it's hopeless, I can tell you where to go. The tomb is empty. Jesus is a living Savior. He rose from the dead, triumphant over death and sin and hell. And he looked death in the face and said, I win. I have the final word. If you're searching and hurting and hopeless today, do what I did. Cry out to God and ask for his truth to be revealed. He will show you his Son. In a beautiful way, he will reveal his Son to you, which he did to me more than 40 years ago. And these words are not just mere words on a page translated thousands of years ago. These are living, breathing words that can look death in the face today and abolish this horrible curse. Jesus says to you, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he was die, yet shall he live. Cry out to Jesus today and find your hope, your freedom in him. This is Randy Noble thanking you very much for coming alongside of me today. I will see you next Monday for another live broadcast on the Cross in the Desert. Have an incredible week.
Seas that are shaped. from